Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Is This Just Fantasy? I'm your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I'm the other host, Duncan Nicol.
And it's a very special episode today because we are rounding out 2025.
That we are, Geordie. Another year, another season on the podcast has come to a close. The sun will finally set on this era.
Looking back at this year, I think, Duncan, this is actually a pretty good one. All in all, I think that the average quality of books that we looked at was pretty high.
Oh, that's a very interesting opinion, because I was going to come in and say something a bit different. I was going to say this year's probably been one of our more rockier ones. Oh. Not obviously in quality of our content, but in terms of the books we've covered, I think we've had quite a lot of ups and downs. We've been quite adventurous this year, I feel, in terms of seeking out, you know, interesting literature from the corners of the last century to review, and that's given us quite a unique palette, shall I say, to some of the books we've covered.
I understand what you mean. I guess I'm just feeling optimistic. It is, after all, for us, it's still the holiday season. I'm still on holiday. I have, with no question, just gotten back from a holiday within the last 20 minutes. I have not unpacked my bag yet. So, I'm still feeling very merry. Duncan, did you have a good Christmas?
I did have a good Christmas. I had a great Christmas. This is the first Christmas that me and my partner, we brought down a new rule to my family, which is, if you're over the age of 25, you ain't getting a present anymore. You're an adult. Move along. Presents are for the little ones.
Oof.
That's been the general reaction.
Oof.
But genuinely,
very Scroogey,
no,
Duncan.
It's been freeing. It's allowed everyone to just focus on what they want to do, to not have to spend money, to struggling to get gifts, and it's allowed us to push the presents aside and focus on the true meaning of Christmas. We still got together. I still met up with my whole family. We still had an amazing day and a delicious meal. Thank you, Mum. You know, it was the true meaning of Christmas, not this commercial gift giving.
We had a whole episode on the true meaning of Christmas, and we both know that it's about abducting children.
Please listen to our Krampus episode for context.
Well, Duncan, what did you not receive this year?
Well, that's the point. I've received nothing. I have nothing extra to add. Normally, I talk in this section about these are the books I got for Christmas, and this is what I'm excited to read and talk about in the new year. But I'm yet to get any gifts. I don't have anything new. So I'm kind of over to you, Geordie. Fill the space. What did you get? What exciting fantasy books were you gifted? Because I'm assuming you must have gotten some.
I got one, yeah. It is one that I had been meaning to do on the podcast. But I think I shall keep it to myself for now. Last time I got Daughter of Smoke and Bone. And of course, we read that and we both enjoyed it. That was one of the highlights of the year. But did it crack the best books we read this year? We read some good ones this year, didn't we? We read The Witcher, we read The Black Company, we read Watership Down, we read Magician, that was okay. We read Daughter of Smoke and Bone, there was a lot of good stuff. So, Duncan, if you had to say, looking back at this year, was there anything that surprised you?
Okay, people, so let's get this format down. Yes, let's look back at this year, and you're right. Surprising, disappointing, best, worst, favourite. The words that get bounded about, what do they mean? So let's start out with the most surprising book of the year. Now, surprisingly interesting, could this just mean a mismatch in expectations, a positive mismatch in expectations? And obviously, it tends to go to a book that I normally haven't heard of before. Generally, what makes it a surprise, Geordie, probably one of your picks, where I go, don't know what that is, never heard of the author. Let's give it a ride. Mm. And this year, I kind of thought about this. And can I just say, my best book of the year almost was the most surprising, my favourite and the best. But I felt that's not fair. That doesn't suit the
Interesting.
Format. I need to be a little bit more outreaching. But my most surprising book of the year was Paladin's Grace.
Mm.
It was. Hadn't heard about it. Didn't know what it was. And I enjoyed
and Duncan,
myself.
It was the same for me. Paladin's Grace was also the most surprising. Because even though, yes, I did pick it, I really had no idea what it was about. And it was a very positive surprise. I enjoyed it so much.
this was a book that, again, this is really maybe talking to the fact that it wasn't in our general circles. Interesting enough, despite never hearing this about this book before you brought it to me, Geordie, I've now been in Waterstones literally today, and I'm like, oh yes, there is the series on the shelf. How have I never noticed you before? So I think this maybe speaks...
Is this one of a series which, like, your sister enjoys and you borrowed it off her?
No, not even that. I had to get this thing on Kindle in the end. This is the book, Geordie, that I went to my local library and they were like, we can order that in for you, sir. And I was like, thanks. And they're like, come back in 3 days. Came back in 3 days and they're like, we're really sorry. We ordered it in, but when we order books in, they don't keep it like behind the desk for you. They put it on the ordered in bookshelf, which you can just go and take things off and check them out. So they're like, yeah, someone else has taken it. And I'm like, how does this system work? Why is that a good idea? I paid £1 for you to bring it to this library. That shouldn't be the system. So I ended up having to give my money to Jeff Bezos once again.
So, Paladin's Grace, we enjoyed this. It was about, it's a romance story. It's about a perfumer and a paladin. The paladin has fallen from grace, teehee. And it's a bit of an odd couple. These two people are... ready to move on to a new stage in their life. Unlike a lot of the romances that we've enjoyed, or not enjoyed on the podcast, as it were, this was between mature adults. They were characters in their 40s. They had, if not previous relationships, then they had previous lives they were moving on from. And that gave it this novel twist for me. It wasn't really like a lot of romances that I've read in the past. At least where romance is like the central feature of the book. It was funny too, it was imaginative, and it even made me want to read on into the rest of the series. Now, I didn't read on into the rest of the series because I didn't like the next book very much at all.
Well, that's fortunate. But it definitely had a really nice balance, I think, of the characters both being a focus of a romance plot, but also having a good narrative going on around it. There's kind of this murder mystery aspect in this book that I really kind of enjoyed and was like, okay, where's this going to go? Also, and I think I said at the time, Jordy, that this was quite novel for me, but maybe isn't novel in the genre in general. But it's one of the first times I've read one of these romantasy novels that gives just as much time and perspective to both romantic leads. They're both POV characters. You follow them along. You see how each of them are seeing the relationship and interpreting or misinterpreting the other's actions throughout the book. And that was actually really refreshing for me, not to have that kind of singular, you know, standoffish, slightly more mystical, or what's going on. Particularly in a lot of the romantices, it's the bad boy archetype. Come on, Court and Thorns and Roses, going back to Twilight, even in Fourth Wing. They're over there, they're there to be eye candy, to be desired by a main character. This one I really felt like, right, you two are of level footing, or like, you know, equally top billing in this story. And that's nice. Don't see it a lot. It was very refreshing.
It's not like anything we've read on a podcast. I will just say, no, it's not breaking new ground in that romantasy space. There are plenty of romancy books which I've read where... you see it from both characters' perspectives. Normally, it's because they're like, it's the enemies to lovers thing, right? The thing that's keeping them apart is not one character's anxiety or lack of belief that the hot bad boy could possibly be interested in her. It's because they have a very good reason to not get on. And that's that they're on the other side of a conflict. So I'm thinking, like, To Kill a Kingdom is a good example. That, like, Raylo fan fiction that got turned into a book. But yes, it's not something we've seen on the pod. And even Fourth Wing, we know for now that Zayden's a perspective character in the next book.
You're right. Maybe individually these elements are not unique for those well-read in the genre. But certainly for me, it was a particular cocktail of flavours that I hadn't had before. And that's what makes it my most surprising book of the year. And I'm glad you thought the same, Geordie. But Geordie,
now,
got to do the other side?
Now, it's not to say that it was like a perfect book, because we also obviously had a lot of criticisms about the book and about things that were left hanging and like some dissatisfying things in the climax. So even though it definitely couldn't crack my favourite book of the year, it was that novelty which pushed it forward, because there wasn't really anything else this year which I could say, no, that was a very positive surprise.
I feel like now we're going to get into a lot of negative surprises, or disappointments, as they're otherwise referred to. So, Geordie, we've had an up, let's look at a down. The most disappointing book of the year. And again, I want to be clear, this is not us necessarily calling this a bad book. It's just, it didn't meet the expectations that either its reputation or the general zeitgeist kind of gave to it. So, Geordie, would you like to say yours first?
My most disappointing for this year was The Woman in Black. This really was a letdown. It was not even remotely what I thought it was going to be. I picked it because I wanted a genuinely scary story, and I had been told this is one of the scariest books ever. And it is not scary.
I'm so glad you picked The Woman in Black. Do you know, I was so close to making this my one, and I'll tell you now, I swerved at the last moment. But Geordie, this book, particularly, now I've not seen the stage play, which I know had a lot to do with your expectations, but I had seen the film. And you know what people say, the book's exactly. Always better than the film. Gosh, I was ready to be so scared. I was actually almost worried. I was like pre-freaking myself out with how scared I was that I was going to be scared.
It really is hard to put into words. Like, how do you describe something not being funny? Like, you can talk about it being painfully unfunny. This is almost painfully unscary. Like, at what point am I supposed to go, oh yeah, I should be scared right now, but it's not working. It didn't even feel like she tried, Susan Hill, like she tried to scare us.
I think that's genuinely the best way to describe it. I know when I've read comedy books that haven't like made me laugh, and I had talked to my partner about them, and I go, it's not that the jokes weren't funny, it's just that the joke per page ratio was shockingly low. And That's what this book was for scares. There were so many sections of this book where you go huge sections, and I kind of get maybe what was meant to be happening here, you know, it's about drawing you into the gentle ambience before the fear kind of kicks in. But I'll tell you now,
that's why it's
cover
just
to cover.
Descriptions of bogs and houses.
Cheese. Don't forget cheese and farmers and pubs.
It was remarkable that we could really be wishing that it was more Hollywood. Like, the movie added all this extra drama and all these extra scenes about people being angry that Daniel Radcliffe's character is going to the house because he's going to imperil the children, and this big sort of seance at the end where they're trying to set the ghost to rest. And normally, I feel like we'd be of the opinion that Hollywooding up a book like this, which is slow and serious and that, and make it more dramatic and striking, is sort of juvenile. But it really did need that, because it was just dry. And I couldn't believe it when it was over. And it was like, oh, nothing happened. Genuinely, it was incredible.
Looking back over my notes to this book, when I was reading it, the most common critique that I kind of had that came up again and again and again, that really made this not hit home for me, is not just writing scares, that's air quotes there, people, because we're not a visual podcast, scares into the book. It's about writing a character who is afraid and experiencing fear. The main character in this book, whose name I have already forgotten, never seems that scared themselves. So how can I get drawn into it and feel their fear?
And at the end of the day, something that just doesn't work about it is that it's not even like an original thought. There's nothing stirring or new about it. It's a pastiche. And Duncan, you love pastiche stories, but it's just an old school E.R. James style ghost story told in that style. And you could just go back and read the short and sweet E.R. James books, or the other James, whose name I've forgotten.
There are better things to do with your time. That said, the adaptations, the movie, and as Geordie can attest to, the stage play, amazing. Give them a watch. Geordie, though, do you want to hear what my most disappointing book was?
I am intrigued. I'm wondering if your disappointment is less so about I had high expectations going in, and more about unfulfilled promise, like something was almost but not quite there.
sometimes that hurts more. Because if something's just bad, you can kind of just leave it. You know, you forget about it. You don't need to rewatch The Phantom Menace. But when something's almost good, you spend hours with Revenge of the Sith thinking, gosh, you're so nearly great. And, sorry, this book did the same for me. Red Sonja Consumed by Gail Simone.
Mm.
I love Red Sonja as a character. In fact, I've been reading a bit more Red Sonja over the Christmas period. Red Sonja His Master's Voice. It's Red Sonja Volume 7. Gosh, there's been so many. And I love Gail Simone's version of Red Sonja. We covered the comic book earlier this year with Red Sonja, the Queen of Plague. And I really enjoyed it. Geordie, I think you enjoyed it. You know, you saw, maybe it wasn't the high end, but it certainly had its own rompy fun. Yeah. I'm a bit sad. And then this book came along. The first prose novel for 30 years, written by one of my favourite bit comic writers, Gail Simone. And the transition to prose didn't seem to quite work out. I still see potential, though. I still look at it and go, Gail Simone, there are scenes, there are moments that completely land. And there are also scenes upon scenes upon scenes of, like, why are we doing this? What is this adding? You've taken a point and you hammed it home in a scene. I went, ah, they're a bad guy. And then we cut back to them. You go, oh, they're still a bad guy. And you cut back again and go, still a bad guy. And you're like, why? Why do I need to see this?
What I'm realizing now, like, with you phrasing it like this, that if we hadn't done Red Sonja Consumed, like, if we just done the comic book and you had been, you know, if you'd been satisfied with that, then the thing that almost could be, if you went by the same metric, in this place could be Krampus, because it had a lot of similar problems where it was like, it was a bit repetitious, it was boring in place, it was slow, and it failed to live up to its promise. But I have to agree that Red Sonja was simply more offensive. It was just frustrating and grating in its way.
And these aren't even problems that I have as a Red Sonja Conan superfan, because I'll tell you now, I've moaned to many people why Zingara and Zamora should not be joining forces as nations to do a raid on Hycania. I have said to many, most people don't appreciate it. I don't understand why. These are real problems in the book's pacing, in the chosen focus, and generally just a sense of bloat. But that, as you alluded to, what really burnt is the fact that there is somewhere in here, maybe a classic Conan length 60 page short story that would have kind of worked just well enough for me.
I know what you mean. I do know what you mean. Ugh, man. I've actually just been looking at our list of all the books we've done this year, and I kind of don't know what I'm talking about. You're right, Duncan. There were some real duds this year going over it. I guess I really was in a merry mood, but there was a lot of disappointments. Like, Magician was pretty disappointing, right? You come at it with a lot of expectations. This is a classic. We didn't really like it. You were very excited about The Bonesmith. I did not like that at all. I wouldn't classify it as disappointing, no.
I want to just push back on that. I know you've just said Magician. I ultimately still walk away with Magician with quite a positive opinion. I think that is a book still worth people's time for its sheer gumption and its sense of scale and changing perspectives. And it's, I think Rift War as a series is something worth your time. But if that's how you felt, if it would be bigged up in your mind, Geordie, obviously I will never deny you.
Now we've done positive surprise, we've done the negative surprise and the disappointment. What will be next, Duncan? Is it favourite next?
Shall we go? Yes, let's go another positive. You're right. Positive, negative. Let's talk about our favourites. So, people, what do I mean by favourites? Well, favourites is a word that I use to get in two best books of the year. It's also a recognition that what we may respect in a novel may not align to our own personal, I was about to use the word kinks, I don't mean kinks, tastes. A classic example may be You know, I have a real passion for short, pulpy sword and sorcery. And that's within me. That's just what I love. I also have a real soft spot for urban detective fantasies. It's weird, but it's certainly a niche in the genre. But that, I can still step back and sometimes and go, this isn't actually a great book, even though I had a lot of fun with it. So it's not the best, but it's my favourite. So Geordie, do you want to share your favourite or can I just jump in?
Well, I got to say, Duncan, every year I forget that we do a favourites section. I forget it's not just the best one. And I appreciate because we are both in agreement on the podcast that favourite is not always best. I mean, thinking about it through the episode, wondering if I was going to change my mind, and I really just can't bring myself to, because this year my favourite is the best one. It is both the best and it's my favourite, and I can't be budged by this. If I had to pick a runner-up, I'd probably pick Berserk Millennium Falcon arc, because I do love it a lot, but it's also one of the disappointing bits, because I don't like this section on Griffith, so it just can't compete. And no, I'm going to hold my cards to my chest and I'll wait to the end for the best book, which is also my favourite.
Very well. I just want to say that when I write this out, I put runners-up in for every role, and Berserk was a runner-up for my favourite this year, particularly because it was the first time reading Berserk that I actually said to myself, oh, this is Berserk to me now. Berserk has finally stopped being the Golden Age, plus some other stuff. Now, this other stuff, this band of characters that we see develop from the Conviction arc into the Millennium Falcon arc, this is now Berserk. And that was so incredible that I was like, oh no, I really want to sing the praises of Berserk.
Wow, that's great.
But there's another book which I just couldn't quite bring myself to call it the best. And part of that is because, and this may be cheating, I've read other books by this author. And I know that although I love this book, it's not their best. And it's not the best of this series. So I didn't want to call it the best. But damn it, it is one of my favourites.
Now I think I know where we're going.
Okay. Say it together, Fjordy. My favourite book of the year was Black
Witcher,
Company.
Witcher, The Last Wish. Oh yeah, Black Company, of course. I forgot you'd read other Black Company books. Recently you were talking about reading so much of The Witcher, so I guess that's what I thought of.
No, I would love to talk more about The Witcher. It was actually, I literally wrote it under honourable mention, because it didn't quite hit any key point. And to say, that's not a reflection on The Witcher as a series. It was actually a reflection on the short stories in The Last Wish, in particular. Ultimately had me going, now, this ain't peak Witcher just yet. But back to The Black Company, my favourite. Oh gosh, this book is written with such, I think, sort of a heartfelt honesty for the brutalities of war it wanted to depict. There's something about the way that we get really in the head of our narrator, the character Croker, the physician for this mercenary company, on this campaign in this truly evil sorceress's army, and how it kind of pivots the focus from this sort of military fantasy into a reflection of the author's real experiences serving the US military. And I don't have any real military experience, so a bit of faith going on here, but the kind of the refocusing of, no, it's not about the exciting bits, it's not grand charges on horseback. Let's talk about playing poker once you've finally taken a fort. Let's talk about standing on the sidelines and feeling numb with the horrors that have just gone down in front of you. Let's talk about the fact that although this is your company and those are your brothers, they are some evil people, and you have to kind of rationalize the fact that you're on their side, you have their back, you are a unit, despite the fact that you watched them do some sickening things.
Yeah, I mean, they are fantastic. It was a fantastic book. I promised myself that I would read more of The Black Company, because I also absolutely, I completely devoured this book. I want to know more. And I will in time. It hasn't happened yet, but you're absolutely right. And it was interesting that a theme really did emerge by accident this year of, you know, books by soldiers. You talked about how this book by Glenn Cook, who I think we figured this out in the episode, but like was not necessarily a Marine, but was like stationed with Marines, and I don't think saw combat. And then there was a similar story for the Deed of Pax Narian. The author of that book, she was also based with the Marines in Vietnam, or at least during the Vietnam War, although she was like a computer person. So she also did not see active combat. But her book is also about the boring bits. It's about the marching, and it's about the camping, and it's about trying to get about boot camp, and it's about training, and it's about wages. And yet, there's a really striking difference between these books, and it just comes down to the striking way in which The Black Company is written, where you can't believe how little you're being told. In The Woman in Black, we talk about how nothing scary happens. Well, even less happens in this book, right? We are never told about exciting battles happening. It's never shown on the page. Battles are either said, we took the city, and that's the battle, or it's, we sneak behind enemy lines, and there's a lot of big build-up and anticipation, and then Croker's not there for the battle, because he's, like, chopping people's legs off as the company medic. And it's amazing. The fact that we are not permitted to see this stuff, and therefore we fill it in with our imagination, it's wonderfully done by Glenn Cook.
I'm glad you shared in my kind of emotions on this one, because it was a book I was kind of scared to introduce to you, and I'm glad we're on the same page. Geordie, I cannot recommend to you and to all our listeners enough, if you read Black Company, and there are many caveats, as by how much I love the book, around people I recommend Black Company to, and very fair, kind of trigger warnings and points need to be made about it. If you do read the original, read Shadowlingers, the second book. It may be my favourite in the series. Absolutely incredible work.
Go to our episode for more of why we liked it. But I think there's been enough positivity now. It's time to get down and dirty.
Let's do it. Let's talk about what book this year. You know, this isn't personal taste anymore. We're drawing out what we feel, what we think with all our critical subjectivity was just the worst book. The one we wouldn't recommend anyone to read unless your tastes were grossly different to our own. Just basically, do you know how I decide this book? I basically sit there and go, what's just the book that I'd rather just sit on my own staring out the window versus reading again for the same time? And there was one book this year that absolutely scored against that criteria.
Okay.
But Geordie, I've hogged the limelight. What was your pick for the worst book?
Well, Duncan, for me, I wrestled with this for a bit, but my contempt could not be held back. My pick for the worst book this year, and it just irritates me even talking about it, is the Thin Family Moomin Troll. I can't stand these stupid little hippos. If I had to hear one more thing about their goddamn picnics, these little bastards. No, that, none of that's true. That book's fine.
I genuinely was like, how do I respond to this? How do I keep this podcast, like, I'd say PG. It isn't PG. But how do I respond without basically cussing you out at this point? After I just said I respected your opinion no matter what.
No. I will actually say, though, I don't remember anything that happened in Thin Family Moomin Troll. Like, not a thing. And I liked it when I read it, but I can't remember a thing that happened in that book. So I think when we do our next big episode review, I don't think Thin Family Moomin Troll is actually going to score that well.
It's certainly a book that, and just to kind of respond to that, and people maybe hadn't listened to the episode, it's certainly something I think we came away thinking, I see why this is actually a really good book for the target demographic. And it's one of those occasions where we really had to go, yeah, we're not that demographic, so it's not hitting us in the same way.
But my actual worst book of the year was John Carter of Mars.
Wow. I'm about to say I'm surprised. I'm not. It's different to my pick, but that is a very fair runner-up. And to be honest, Judy, I'm mostly just relieved you didn't pick something like Straight Razor's Cure. I'm like, oh, thank good. that one has just snuck under the radar.
No, I mean, like, and I'm sure you might well have expected me, Duncan, to pick something like The Bonesmith, because I really did rail against it. But it's not the worst book we read. If anything, that one was closer to being disappointing, because it's just like, oh, it's just more of the same, you know? It's very bog standard. But this was John Carter, Princess of Mars. God, it was hard to get through. God, it was so hard. I was just willing myself to get to the end. And it's not long. It really isn't. So even though I'm like, oh yeah, I can appreciate that this is an influential book, I was doing this whilst I was like playing video games, just so that I could keep myself in the same space with the book. Because if I just had it, like, in my lap, on my screen, or in my ears whilst I was walking about, I would change. I would put on a podcast. I'd watch a YouTube video instead. It's boring. It's not exciting.
It's a real shocker from the man that wrote Tarzan. And I've read quite a few of the Tarzan novels, and I really enjoyed them. Like, you say, you know, they are exciting at their core amongst many other problematic things. And so going over to Princess of Mars and being like, cool, the same writing, the same energy, but in an alien, fantastical world, how could this not be brilliant? And the fact that it achieves dullness is so aggravating, surprising, I don't know, but it does.
I have to say, it was so bizarre to finish this book and then watch the movie, which is like one of the least successful films of all time, and being like, wow, that was so much more fun. That was so much more engaging.
I've had similar experiences. I'm a big fan of Dynamite Comics' Warlords of Mars series, which adapts this book and makes it so much more fun by cutting out the fluff, by giving visuals to this beautiful world. And that just doesn't come across in the book.
And you can't say in the comic book, and I started to fight the big green Martian, and we fought for an hour. And to Edgar Rice Burroughs, clearly being was like, yeah, that's exciting. The idea that your fight is so desperate and close, that you, even after an hour of fighting, a winner hasn't been decided. And I'm in, and to me, I'm reading that, I'm like, that is the least interesting way you could have possibly written that. You might as well have written, and it was the coolest fight ever.
It's very much the opposite of, like, not every fight scene in a book has to be blow-by-blows. Talking about Glenn Cook just moments ago, who, when he does do fight scenes, which are rare, it often reads like war poetry followed by, oh yeah, and they won. This is just, it's short and non-descriptive, so you have nothing there to even unpick and pull apart.
I'll tell you this, Duncan, something that definitely wasn't, it was way too middle of the pack to be anywhere near a favourite or least favourite, because it was just like, okay. We read The Legend of Drizzt this year, and I have now continued on. I think I've read four more Drizzt books since we've done that. Oh, five, sorry, excuse me. And I really like them. They are kind of my guilty pleasure. They're not high art, and they are often kind of familiar in their in how they unfold. But the only thing about it which I really springs to mind right now is how R.A. Salvatore will lead you through a sword fight in exacting detail. Like, you cannot believe how long he will go describing the blow-by-blow of Drizzt fighting a bunch of drow, or going head-to-head with a master duelist. And you're like, oh, this is still going. We have cut to several different scenes with Cassie, Bree, and Regis, and he's still having this sword fight.
I mean, that is incredible. Very, I think Brandon Sanderson has a real reputation for taking that approach. Just like moment to moment, you never kind of leave the flow of action for just like general descriptions and vibes of fights.
I mean, he did write a 100,000 word chapter in The Last Wheel of Time, which is just one battle. So yeah, that checks out.
Jordy, I have nothing really else to add on Princess of Mars. I suppose if we had to give it the slightest bone, obviously it was very influential, and you can draw many lines back to it. But do you know what? You don't need to read the original to appreciate those kind of literary influences.
and you could just read Tarzan.
And you'll have a much better time of it. Have you read the original Tarzan now? I know when we did Princess of Mars, you hadn't.
I told you this during the episode, but I started reading Tarzan, and I really enjoyed it, but I just got distracted, probably by this podcast. But yeah, I didn't even get up to Tarzan being born. Like, his parents had just been dropped off in Africa by the mutineers, and it was really good. Like, even though, like, the action, so to speak, hadn't started yet, it was very exciting. Like, the mutiny itself, and like the boiling tension underneath, it's so much more engaging than any of the politicking that happens in this book. And it's funny, too. Like, Tarzan's dad being this, like, easygoing, very reserved, stiff upper lip Englishman being like, "Now, gentlemen, I know that your business is with the captain and not me, so you should leave my betrothed and I out of it. Now, if you need me, I'll be in my cabin with my guns drawn."
I don't know how much I love that book. Again, issues, but gosh, has a way of writing the English.
Yeah, that's one to press on with. But Duncan, your worst book of the year, and it wasn't A Princess of Mars.
It was not. This book had many a fault. And many a fault that you can draw comparison between this book and, say, something like Princess of Mars. What this book did, though, that Princess of Mars didn't do, and this is the one thing that made it worse in my opinion, even if there maybe were one or two teeny tiny nuggets of gold that shone brighter than in Princess of Mars, this book was like three times the length. So you know what? Sod it. If you're going to be dull, you can at least be brief. So, Sheep Farmer's Daughter, I know there are fans out there. I do not get you. I do not relate. Whoa. This was the hardest book for me to get through. I took it on holiday, and it damn near ruined that holiday for me. Oh, this book was dull. This is...
I'm surprised that it's Deed of Pactionary. I also don't like this book. I really thought you were going to go for Dragon Riders of Pern.
Dragon Riders of Pern. Again, dull, but some good ideas, some nifty notions, and, again, a little bit briefer. This book is like the dark flip of Black Company. And maybe that's why I've dropped it even lower in my estimations, because at least Black Company... No, not at least Black Company. Because Black Company is so exemplary in all the ways that Sheep Farmer's Daughter isn't. Sheep Farmer's Daughter is a tale of a mercenary company in a fantasy world, and we follow a new recruit, how they go through the company, how they kind of grow up, they learn about the world, traveling with his band. There are fights, there are events that happen, but what really kills it and is that the focus is on that kind of trudgery of being in armed services. You know, the fact that between every fight, there's getting your boots stuck in the mud. There's having a chat around the fire with your mates. There's going into the local town and getting screwed over because you don't really get how the currency's being transferred there. And I can't quite grasp what it is, but where, say, Black Company, you've got these really, like, alive and complex characters where Glenn Cook does this amazing work or giving you just a glimpse of them, just a silhouette, the nickname, you know, One Eye, the lieutenant, the captain's just the captain. In Sheep Farmer's Daughter, at the end of every battle, it's like, and Dave and Tony died. You're like, who the hell were they?
Exactly.
There's generally a moment in this, while reading this book, that I messaged Geordie on my holiday going, "Geordie, it's just told me that Callum died." Had Callum been mentioned yet in the book? What a missed opportunity. You go at the start of this book and the main character, whose name I have forgotten,
Pactionarian,
is like, joins their... Pactionarian, you're right. They go into the barracks on their first day and you meet a couple of characters. I'm like, great, we're going to get to know them. Are they going to grow? No. There is one person who gets like three scenes before they die. And there's one tiny bit in the middle of the book where, and I think I said this in the review, the bit that made me most annoyed is there's this tiny section where like a fortress is captured while they're out like foraging for food. And then they have to sneak back to the main company, like from behind enemy lines. And it's really quite gripping. It's really tense. And she was like, don't get caught. They're having to like, can we trust the locals? And I'm like, great. So you could write well. And for some reason, you chose not to.
And
that, my friend.
And there's a classic trope in, you see in action movies, you see in fantasy novels, where at the end of a big action scene, or even like at the end of someone getting captured or something, they'll get bonked on the head and they'll get knocked unconscious. And it's a really, really cheap way of ending a scene. You don't have to write about the falling action. You don't have to go through the busy work of saying, and things wound down, and then I went to the medic or whatever. So every single battle, Paxanarin gets injured, her vision goes hazy, and she gets carried away. And then afterwards, she gets told about how they won or how they lost or whatever. And in the section where Paxanarin is on this march and she's separated from a company, she can't be injured. So the author can't just end scenes. She actually has to write it. She actually has to follow through and do Pax's emotional journey. And she gets like dinged up in places, but she doesn't get taken out. And they have to power through. They have to fight. And yes, as you say, that one bit is very exciting. And you think, is this the rest of the book? Is the rest of the book about, we've set Paxanarin up to be, to teach her to fight, and now this is heroic moment. Everything's gone wrong, she has to be the figurehead to save her army. And it's not. It's an episode in a larger story, which is not concluded in this one. And there's all these other just dropped stories. I remember we talked about at the end of that book, towards the end of that book, Pax gets picked to go on a rescue mission. And I think to myself, ah, yes, we're almost at the end of the book. This is the beginning of the climax. Pax is going to go on this mission. Things are going to go wrong. And then she's going to have to, like, fight her way back to the army. Or she's going to, like, be captured by the bad guys and have to arrange an escape. Maybe kill the guy behind it all. Who can say? But no, there's no escape. There isn't even a rescue. She just does a rendezvous with the people who we were not informed were actually the ones rescuing this guy. And then later, the army gets attacked in the dead of night, and Pax just happens to be the guy, or the woman, in the right place at the right time to take the bad guy out. And that's it. I can't believe there are people who actually say, hi, I want to read books by, like, about, you know, cool female main characters. And they go, read The Deed of Paxanarin. No the fuck you don't read The Deed of Paxanarin.
To be quite honest, you read Fourth Wing before you read The Deed of
Paxanarin.
Hell
yes, read Fourth Wing before you read that.
There's many things that a book can do wrong, but I'm very much, and this does speak to my personal tastes, ultimately, nothing is worse. You can be cringy. You can be predictable, perhaps. No, maybe not predictable. You can be mildly insulting to my intelligent. You can have a Mary Sue. But if you're not boring, I'm prepared to forgive a lot. This book was boring.
I'm going to be slightly more detailed than that. And I'm going to make a distinction, which I hope is important. Some books can be boring, even ones that are supposed to be exciting, as long as they don't feel like they've wasted your time. Because if The Deed of Paxanarin, right towards the end, got really good, and the rest of the book was super boring, it would not be the worst one. Or at least your worst one. It wasn't mine. But if at the end it was like, you know what, that wasn't great, but I'm glad I read it for the cool stuff at the end, I don't think it would be here.
Well, Geordie, that's quite a rant over. Take a deep breath. Reset ourselves. Going to talk about the peak of the peak, the highlight of the year, the creme de la creme, our personal best books of the year. And I'm very interested. You know, we had a match early on. Will we match again? Do we both pick the same best book of the year? I'm suspicious that we're going to. One, because I think it's clearly the best book.
I think it's almost certain that we did, because I don't think its quality can be underestimated. When we do our top 100 next year, this one's going to be forcing its way towards the top, because it is a reason why I could not give any other book this year my favourite, because it's just
that good. I really want to emphasise, this book genuinely, when I first sat down to write out, you know, the winners of my categories, it at one point was the most surprising because I genuinely had a very different idea of what this book was going to be. It won my favourite because I loved it, and it won the best because it was so clearly the best. And if you've listened and been with us for this entire year, you're probably thinking, huh, it's funny they've not mentioned that book yet. So, Geordie, shall we let them all know the best book of the year, the number one pick that they should all go out and give it a go that we're so confident they're going to love? People, it's Watership Down.
Of course it's Watership Down.
This book, Geordie, floored me because, and I really want to stress, by the way, it nearly won my most surprising book because the reputation, particularly through the adaptation, particularly the famously, you know, brutal animated version from like the 80s and the certainly less futuristic CGI version from like the 2010s, I think misrepresent how fundamentally this is a fantasy book. The fantastical elements are so ingrained in the lore, and how when the characters are talking about these sort of mythical figures in their world, and when like the big battles happen, this is the thing, when you watch the adaptation and the big battle happens at the end, you see a bunch of rabbits having a tuss up on a field. When you read the battle at the end of Watership Down, you feel the Helm's Deep, that's easier to say, Helm's Deep level siege and fight and last stand that these rabbits make.
It has this sense of gravitas to it because we see the journey which Hazel and co. go on. And right from the start, you think to yourself, yeah, I get it. A journey from one field to another is really big for some rabbits. But the trials they overcome, they do feel like something right out of The Hobbit or The Odyssey. They go, they have their Isle of the Lotus Eaters with the, you know, the Silver Wire farm.
Mm-hmm.
Where these people are strange and you don't know why. We were both coming up with theories whilst we were reading the book about why are these people so strange? Is it chemicals in the ground? I thought they might be eating cigarette butts. And no, it's much more interesting. It has something to say about the rabbits, about their rabbitness, the fact that they're off. And this is, you know, it's we come away with this unsettled feeling. It speaks to how Richard Adams is able to put us in the realm of rabbitness, that we're able to relate so strongly to these rabbits, not because they're anthropomorphized, although they are, but because we are now in their heads, we're in their culture, we are thinking about El Herrera, and we're thinking about Rududus.
You're right, and the amount of detailed characterization, this is something that, you know, maybe it's a very easy critique of, say, something like The Hobbit, or even most renditions of The Odyssey. I've never read the original one, but I've read two different kind of for children versions of the story, is that you have your main character, you have Bilbo, have Odysseus, and they've got characterization. But a lot of the rest, the crew, the dwarves, they're just a list of names.
It's not a real ensemble.
Watership Down, by the end of the journey, you really do feel for each and every one of these characters. They've all got their own little quirks. And when they're in fights, Geordie, the tension I felt, I'm like, no, don't kill them.
Exactly. And you're in the midst of this great drama for the rabbits. You know, there's this elemental struggle. I know that Richard Adams himself, like, rejected the idea, much like Tolkien of his book being an allegory, but you cannot help but feel the memory, the imprint of World War II on this book, fighting Napoleon, the rabbit fascist, and this, like, might makes right mentality, and this turns into this ideological struggle between Hazel, you know, the independent thinker, the leader who listens to his people, who gathers up other people's knowledge and understanding and cultivates them, leads them forward.
Like, the fear that the general inspires, I was more scared reading this book than ever in The Women in Black. I had appreciation for this band, and I just praised Glenn Clark for like giving you like a silhouette and you kind of see more. Guess what? Richard Ammons, he really fleshes out all of these rabbits. I say all, the vast majority, all the male rabbits in this.
Yeah, that's true. We have critiques for this book, as we do for many of our, as many of the like great books of old. They often need to do more with women, and that's definitely particularly true in this one.
And that scene, the great moment where the two kind of worldviews collide, is you get, I hope I don't get it, is it Bigsby?
Bigwig,
thank you. Bigwig, the muscular rabbit of Hazel's group. I adore the scene when Bigwig is sort of staring down the general, and the general's like, why don't you move? And Bigwig just goes, because my leader told me to hold the line. And the general has this lovely kind of thought where he goes, wait, he's not the leader? Oh my God, okay. How big and tough must the leader be? Because it's so ingrained in his mindset that to be the leader, you have to be the strongest and the toughest. He can't even comprehend that Bigwig is, you know, bending the knee, weird thing for a rabbit to do, to anyone else. Oh.
The one final thing I'd like to say about Warship Down, because it really does, whenever I think about it, it does get me emotional, is the end of the book. Because we have this experience going through the book where it gets broken up by these very well-written short stories, which are delivered in an oral tradition, stories of El Arera, where characters like Silver will sit down and he will retell an old story about this plucky trickster hero and how he was clever enough to trick his way out of danger against, you know, the foxes and the eagles and gnats and the kings of the other rabbits, and he always wins through. And then right at the end, a very, very old Hazel is sat there listening to other rabbits tell little kits about the adventures of El Arera, and he recognizes, or half recognizes, something that sounds familiar about El Arera freeing people from the silver wire, or figuring out how to use the train to like get across to escape from danger. And he's like, oh, that sounds so familiar, but I can't remember why. And it lays out in plain language, it lays out plainly that all these other stories we've heard of El Arera were always stories about other rabbits, about other heroes who went through danger and came out the other side and live long enough to tell their story and pass down their wisdom to these future generations so that they could learn from their mistakes and from their successes and they could go on. And it's this legacy, this fire handed down as a gift of life to those who've yet to come. And it makes me so emotional to think about that.
I very much agree with you. It's this beautiful sense of history that's then imbued into the book. And drawing a comparison to, say, someone like Tolkien, one of the joys of reading Lord of the Rings is that you really get a sense that behind every kind of throwaway tale or story or snippet, there is this wider history to this world. And it makes it so much richer than just the story you're seeing. And that little bit at the end, that little kind of twist on the legends that we've been hearing throughout the book, all of a sudden makes you go, oh, this isn't just a mythology, this is more of a mythicized, if that's the right word, history of
mythologized.
Oh, I should know that word. History of the rabbits. And you're like, oh my gosh, I can now see you and I can kind of relate to them. And I also think it gets this really sweet, like, the tales will go on, like there will be more legends formed, and it gets this nice kind of middle point. It's like, this is just one episode in the grand history.
Something that is now tainting this memory for me is I'm realizing that since we did our episode, a lot of what I think about when it comes to the oral tradition, I think about my time doing Native American literature in North Carolina. And in that, my favorite book was The Truth About Stories by Tom King. who was a very preeminent and successful Native American writer. And I say was, not because he's dead now, and not because his like works are disgraced or cancelled, not really. It's more like they've been recategorized, because it turns out that guy who did such a good job writing about Native American literature and the oral tradition and the truth about stories recently found out that he's not Native American.
Okay, I do not have nearly enough context to really comment on what.
Yeah, it's really it was a real blow to me to be like, oh man, that dude was my favorite writer in doing that course, and now it does not count. Everything he said is now in serious doubt because it lacks a certain authenticity, unfortunately.
Sad times, I think, for you?
It's pretty sad for him. Like, other people were like, hey, Tom King, I don't know if your ancestry, as you've, you know, shown us, is accurate. Do you want to take a DNA test? And he's like, no, I don't need to do that. I know where my family is. And then finally, he did do it. It was like, oh, beans. Turns out you guys were right. I'm not Native American, and I need to give back a lot of awards.
I mean,
anyway, at least he owned up to it.
Back to books, though. That's it. Watership Down, winner of the year by A Country Mile. And there's been some really good books this year. Like I said, I adored Black Company, obviously Paladin's Grace. I do think this was a year of maybe less home runs. And I think that's very fair. I think there's a lot of books that were very mixed.
Sure.
To be fair, that's most of what's written. Most of what's written is a mixed bag.
That's true.
Of great and good and mediocre and bad stuff. And it's just where that kind of makes the book fall for you, and whether or not, you know, you personally got enjoyment. We're not the orbiters of enjoyment. Orbiters? Orbiters.
Auditors.
Of enjoyment. If you like a book...
First of all, yes, we are the auditors of enjoyment. It's our podcast. We decide what's good.
But we don't decide what you enjoy. I merely hope, you know, to give a guidance and a flavour and start a conversation. Because some books, genuinely, I find that conversation can make you see it in a very different light. Or you can derive enjoyment out of discussing a book.
That's definitely been the case for books we've done on this podcast.
I have to say, like, talking about really big one for me this year, and it's brought up a little bit, was Well-Met and Lankmar. Reading that book...
Ill-Met. The opposite.
Was that the opposite? Do you enjoy it less after talking about it? I enjoy talking about it. I felt like I got...
No. You called it Well-Met and Lankmar. It's called Ill-Met and Lankmar, which means the opposite of that.
You're absolutely right. I'm so sorry. See, this is what happens when you record late in the year, okay, after Christmas, after a lot of wine and booze.
Yeah, yes. He's full of eggnog right now.
That was a book that maybe I enjoyed the story well enough, but it kind of run me the wrong way in areas. But I definitively loved discussing it with you and pulling it apart.
Yes, totally. Absolutely. And Fourth Wing too. Just talking about it with you gave me nice, warm, fuzzy feelings, and it made me feel better. It made me enjoy the book more. I appreciated it more afterwards. Even though we spent so much of that book ragging on it, it's nice to talk about. It's nice to discuss.
I hope we can keep creating these sort of experiences as we go forward. And so I just want to kind of bring it to you and say thank you, everyone, for joining us in 2025. The most successful year for the podcast we have ever had. Mm-hmm. Our community continues to grow. And that's always such a pleasure to see. If you want to be a more active part of the community, do check out our Instagram, It's a Fantasy Podcast. It's the best place to get up-to-date releases on what's going on and extra content and reviews as we put them out.
Uh-huh.
Jordy, before we go forward, end of the year, start of the new. Do you have any New Year's resolutions, podcast-related, fantasy book-related? I don't need to hear about your diet plans.
You know what I think, Duncan? Coming up, we're going to have our 100th episode, and then our 101st episode is going to be us reviewing our top 100. We're going to look at every book we've done on a podcast up to now. I love doing our top 50 episode. This is going to be yet more definitive. And so I want, with the last spate of episodes we have, 8 books. We have 8 books left to round out that list. And... what I want I want us to get some of the best books you've ever done, and I want to get some of the worst books you've ever done. I'm actually going to deliberately find shit books.
That's concerning.
I want nothing in the middle this year. It's highs and lows. We have to spice up that top 100. We already know what's going to be in the bottom five already. It probably hasn't changed from last time. Let's see if we can change that.
Do you know what? That is what I love about doing this so much, is hitting that variety, hitting that spectrum of fantasy. It's such a broad genre, despite sometimes feeling very contained. You know, if I'm talking to someone at a party, like, oh, what do you like reading? And I just say, oh, I like fantasy. I feel like they get such a narrow view of what I mean, and yet there's so much you can read. I'm in a very similar boat, Geordie. I think coming up to the 100, there were some big hitters, some like love letters of fantasy that I've read in the past, mostly books I read before the podcast, that we've never covered, despite the fact they're some of the biggest names in the genre. Do you know what? I'm just gonna drop some now. I'm just gonna say we need to go. We're revisiting Brandon Sanderson.
Don't.
I want that to happen. I want to touch on Scott Lynch.
Fine. Okay. I've never read him.
Do you know what? Despite the myriad of things that have happened and the journey that they've been on, I want us to read a Patrick Rothfuss book.
It's Rothfuss, but okay. I can't say I'm looking forward to much of that. I don't know anything about Scott Lynch. I'm sure he's excellent, but I really don't want to read Patrick Rothfuss. I've spent so much of my life not reading him, and they were like, oh, his first book's great. I'm like, great. I don't give a heck. I don't care. But there we go. Highs, highs, and low lows it is. But as previously discussed on the last episode we did on Krampus, we are still looking forward to your first pick of the year, Duncan, which is A Hero Born, the first book of The Heroes of Condor. No, The Legend of the Condor Heroes.
That's right, by Jin Yong. I am very excited to give this a go. This is a top recommendation for me from my partner's cousin, who is as much of a fantasy fan as I believe you and I are. They certainly read a lot more. They're in the 50 plus book a year camp. So when they say, I think this is my favourite, I take that seriously. I am fascinated to know what this book's going to be like.
This is their favourite? Okay.
This is their most recommended.
Yeah, ask them to put together their best, their best favourite, most surprising and most disappointing list, and then we shall compare notes.
And do you know what? People listening, why don't you tell us some of your best favourite, most surprising, most disappointing books? Particularly surprising and disappointing. Mm-hmm. I think that's a fantastic conversation to have. Because it's like you're letting in subjectivity. You're accepting the fact that, yeah, this is my personal experience. And then you get to talk not only about the book, but then what factors informed your expectations going in. And that's just so interesting.
That's a good point. Duncan? Thank you for doing 2025 with me. I look forward to seeing you in 2026.
Look forward to seeing you then.
Until then, I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
And I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
So long.
Bye.